Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the UI Breakfast Podcast. I'm your host, Jane Portman, and today our special guest is Tim Valashev, co-founder and CEO of JavaChat, and we're going to talk about freemium today. This episode is brought to you by Encrypt.me. Their Teams plan is the ideal VPN service for keeping your business secure. Keep your team safe with your own private servers, content filtering, and other key features. Sign up at encrypt.me/UIbreakfast and save 25% on your initial subscription. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Jane.
Good to see you. Very nice to have you on the show and excited to learn from you.
Thanks for having me.
So before we get started, give us an overview of what JavaChat is and a bit of your background story. Like, what did you do personally before and when you started it?
Sure. JavaChat is a business messenger. It's a platform for communications that teams use to talk to clients on all possible channels via Facebook Messenger, live chat on the website, you know, by email, by phone, and they use to communicate inside the team. So we help to build better conversations with the buyers and customers to optimize sales and support processes. Yeah, and our product is very, very easy to use and good fit for smaller teams.
You shared your background story on Indie Hackers, and I'm going to link to that in the show notes. So you are bootstrapped like a lot of people who are listening to us. How did this whole thing get started?
This is my second SaaS business, and the idea came from the first when I was looking to optimize conversions on my website that I was running back then in 2011. It was Octoline, a hosted PBX service for smaller businesses. So I was struggling with getting signups out of traffic that came from SEO and paid ads, and live chat widgets was something that merged back then. And I was willing to try that, but I didn't like any of the products I saw on the market, and decided that I can do better than other competitors that I found. That's how we got the idea for JavaChat. But another thing about this idea was that we were determined to do it bootstrapped, because I had not very successful experience with an investor with my previous business, and I wanted to have something for myself without any need to report to anyone. That also determined our decision to run with freemium.
How did you manage to get this business off the ground with a freemium, which implies a large number of users, by having a small team to handle support and everything else?
Yes, actually, it was a team of me and my partner in the beginning. We are both programmers. We created the first version of our product and, well, I think started to ask money for it on just 1 month after we released the first beta. That was a very simple product that we created ourselves, but we started asking money for it and we started providing free version of the product so it would spread the word about itself with the Powered by JavaChat link. And I believe we became cash positive on fifth or fourth month after the launch. We made enough money to support ourselves and hire first part-time employee.
You make it sound super, super easy, but just to give our listeners an idea of scale, when was it when you got started, and how many people are on your team today? Like, the scale is pretty massive.
We started in 2012 in January, and right now, 8 years since, we have 130 people on our team, 37,000 paid customers, 300,000 active customers, and I think all of those metrics I've just mentioned grew linearly over the years.
So you didn't quite hit that hockey stick growth that everybody is striving for.
We never tried to show fast growth. Actually, it's the vice versa. I was always scared of growing too fast because, after all, I have a programming background. after I finished my programming education, I enrolled for MBA just to get an idea of how other areas work. But still, I didn't have enough management experience, and I was always scared when I hired another teammate. I was always thinking, what can go wrong? What if I can earn enough money to pay salaries next month? After all, in the beginning, we didn't make that much money. So I think it's a good thing to grow gradually, because with you grow your experience with the company. And I understand how to manage 130 people. I don't think I could do that 3 or 4 years ago, because it would be really hard for me. I didn't have experience to build a team of officers, how to motivate officers, how to give them enough freedom but still keeping things under control. All those stuff came to me. I learned how to do that stuff over the years. I don't know how it would turn out if we grew like a hockey stick.
You make it sound, again, very easy, like you knew what your plan is from day one and you just did the right thing. But has your vision evolved at all over the years? Like, what have you learned that dramatically changed your perspective? Or was it just like you knew what you were doing from day one?
Well, of course not. Of course, we didn't know almost anything when we started. But I think we were lucky enough not to make any serious mistakes. Something that would cost us a lot of time or money. It's true that we made some mistakes. For example, when we launched, we had a bit different pricing model. We had to change that. We made a couple of recruiting mistakes, but who doesn't? But those were minor mistakes and things that we learned. But in general, I think we were lucky to get the right idea about the freemium version and organic traffic that will be generated by it. And probably we got the product idea right to focus on solving a limited number of problems for our customers, but doing it reliably with an easy-to-use tool and focusing on interfaces a lot. So I don't know what I don't know. So probably if we did something differently, we would get that hockey stick that you've mentioned. But it's history.
Do you think part of your success is because you started many years ago when there was not so many SaaS companies around and you didn't have much competition? Or who is your competition these days? Like, how does it work and how has it evolved over time?
Actually, I think when we started, I had a browser folder where I collected competitors at the time. I think I had something like 30 or 40 services that were doing live chat those days. So I can't say that there was no competitors. I think we just knew how to do something better than them. And till this day, we get one or two new competitors every quarter. People continue launching new SaaS services. We compete with companies like Zendesk, LiveChat. I think with some companies who are doing similar products, we don't compete, but we are in different niches, like with Intercom. Intercom was doing a really great product, but it's targeted mostly on software companies and those who have to support large user base. Our product is mostly used for sales and by smaller companies with simpler processes. But yes, the chat industry is growing very fast nowadays with all those big guys opening APIs to their platforms, with Google, Apple, and Facebook. They are trying to get as many business to customer communications as possible to their platforms. And with all those new trends like bots and messenger marketing ideas, there's more and more attention to what we're doing.
Yeah, what do you think about bots, by the way?
Actually, it's a term that covers a lot of use cases where a chat-based conversation can be used to solve different needs of the customers. There was a time when it was a hype saying that bots will be everywhere, they will replace humans, and all interfaces will be converted to bots. Of course, it was a bit exaggerated, but there are some use cases emerged from that hype, like making reservations or scheduling calls that you can do in chat much more comfortable than using forms. Or, for example, handling recurring support questions for bigger companies, companies like telecoms or banks that receive thousands of requests every day. They can use machine learning and bots to improve customer service for those people who are asking recurring questions. Yes, those cases are working, and we are implementing them for some of our customers.
We should probably talk a little bit about the fact that you have not been started in the US and that you started in Russia. So I wonder if you started with the Russian market or if you tackled the global market first and then a few local markets after that. So how did that strategy work out?
Yes, actually, we started in Russia. And I think it's a good thing that we had a domestic market that was growing very fast. At that time, e-commerce was growing very fast in Russia in 2012. Now the speed of growth is a bit slower. And competitors were much easier to work with than, for example, in the United States. That helped us to get to earn cash and then invest it into building better product and going international. Actually, the one thing that I've noticed is that the easiest markets to launch in are those where internet penetration, the metric you can find on Wikipedia, is how many percentage of population have access to internet. So when this metric is between 40 and 70%, it means that the market is developed enough to launch something and sell products, but it's not too saturated and the competition is not too hard. For example, in countries like Russia, Brazil, Turkey, cost of one sign up for us is something between $3 and $5. In countries like United States or United Kingdom or Germany, one sign up can cost up to $50.
Do you differentiate the pricing between different countries?
Yes, of course, we differentiate pricing, but still the pricing of competitors and the cost of advertising is so that it's impossible to get positive ROI. In the United States, for example, we compete with companies who are financed with hundreds of millions of dollars. We don't have those hundreds of millions of dollars. And those companies who pay $50 per sign up, they burn cash to get the hockey stick. We don't do that, and we can't participate in this frenzy. So for us, most reasonable markets are those where we can get positive ROI, where e-commerce is growing, where we can get reasonable cost per click. In most of those markets, by the way, even SEO is still possible. For example, in Brazil, we managed to reach top three positions for all of our target queries in a year, I think. And that's something
that's really impressive.
You can't do that in the United States anymore. The market
you
is,
can never do it anymore there.
Yeah. And so that's how we were growing. We chose markets. So first was Russian market. It was a very good market in those days. It was growing very fast. And that's why I believe we made enough cash to go bootstrapped. Then we launched our English-speaking version, then Portuguese, English, Spanish. We had a couple of unsuccessful experiments. I can't say that those are bad markets, but probably we did something wrong with Indonesian version in Bahasa, with German version, with version for Netherlands. We didn't find the right approach, I think. But we will return to that. Yeah, so right now, Portuguese version is second by cash for us worldwide after English. Then go Spanish and Turkish. Hopefully, we will continue launching new localized version.
We just had an episode with Max Zilliman of Ulysses talking about the giant infrastructure they have for handling releases in multiple countries. Do you consider that as a big marketing burden, let's say, or do you feel it's not that bad?
Well, I wouldn't call it a burden. I would call it complication. Of course, it's it's something you need to take care of. You need to take care of localizations, you take care of network delays, of keeping servers close to their customers. But with the tools that you have at hand, it's possible. AWS gives excellent tools for building infrastructure for that. If you use something like phrase.com for translations. It would be much easier to handle. So I don't see a big problem here, but of course, it makes things a bit more complex.
Let's talk about the freemium itself, the reason why we got here together. And let's start with the benefits. What has your company earned by going freemium from day one?
First of all, we don't have any investors in our company. That's probably due to freemium version in the first place, because what it gave us, we traded software for marketing. So we gave part of our product for free, but in exchange, we received organic growth. That's now amounts for about 75% of our new paid users. So I believe it's an exact number. So 35 paid users in 2019 came from paid channels, and 65 users came from organic. And that organic is mostly generated by our free version of the product. So now, considering this craziness with the virus, it's even possible for us to switch off all marketing campaigns, and we will still be growing. If we didn't have our free version, I don't think it would work that way.
I'll take a side note to give you congratulations on landing in the market which benefited from the virus. So,
well, that's not so obvious for me.
One of the few. Well,
that's what I'm hoping for.
At least some businesses are benefiting from that. So you mentioned that you trade software for marketing. So how strong is your marketing component these days, like if you translate it to human resources? You mentioned you have over 130 people on the team. So which of that is marketing? And another question related to that, what part of your marketing is focused on pre-sign-up efforts and what part on converting freemium users into paid?
Well, our marketing team right now is 5 people, and they handle both inbound marketing and the product marketing. So we have guys who run Google Ads, SEO, who do the website, email campaigns, trigger campaigns, design, all that stuff. So I think our marketing department could be much bigger if we didn't have that organic channel.
What are the efforts spent on converting free users into paid? Do you consider that an uphill battle? Do you dedicate a lot of resources to that or not so much?
For us, it would even work without any in-house sales team. So when we just started, it was all on autopilot. We didn't have sales teams who contacted people. We just had a couple of trigger emails and interface banners. And we still got conversions. We were working in that mode for a bit over a year, but then we realized that we're losing something when we don't introduce human component into the relationships between our product and the user. So that's when we started to build our inside sales team. Guys are calling customers who sign up, who start using our product and have some activity on their account, and they contact people. Make sure that they don't have any problems with the product. They understand how to set everything up. They get value from the product and try and convert him to the paid plan. When we did that, when we introduced the sales team, the conversion almost doubled. The speed of growth of paid account increased twice since that time. So that is very important for us right now. And actually, very often I hear opinions that you cannot afford to provide customer support to free users. You cannot afford to have an inside sales team that contact people. It's not true for us. I think for us, customer support expenses are well under 5% of the revenue, and sales team expenses are something about 11% of our revenue.
Which is also manageable, I imagine, for the scale that you operate at.
I imagine that sales team give us more boost than 11%.
I've read in your Indie Hackers interview that you regret not hiring the sales team from day one. What didn't occur to me is understanding that your sales team works on converting free users to paid, not doing like cold outreach or something like mm-hmm. that. That was quite a revelation just a few minutes ago.
Yeah, I should have made it clear, I think.
So you don't really do any, like, your sales guys, they don't go out there looking for leads. What you're focused on is just working on your free user list, which are super warm, as opposed to cold leads out there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, we have a quite a big organic channel that generates signups. Then those guys convert to active users on their own. And then our sales team kicks in.
Over the years, how have you been learning about what should be included in the free plan? Have you found yourself making it more rich or vice versa, tightening the screws, so to speak?
Well, I don't think that we have ever tightened the screws. When we introduce new features, we always make a decision if we want to include the free or paid version based on how much traction that feature can generate us and how good will it look in the list of features of the paid plan. So if a feature will generate a lot of traction, for example, very soon we will be releasing Team Chat feature, so our customers can use Jive instead of, let's say, Slack for their work communications. We hope that this feature will have a lot of demand from our customers, and actually that's something our users ask us a lot about. And we're thinking that this will improve conversion from signups to active users, and we will put it to the free version. But some features, like recently we released a feature when you have phone conversations, when your team is calling customers or you receive calls from your customers, if the manager doesn't want to listen to the calls to monitor what's going on, he can click a button and convert the record of the call to text. We hope that this feature will be looking good in our paid plan and generate conversions for more active customers with the bigger number of licenses on their account.
If product managers and SaaS founders are listening to us, what would be your general advice in what should go in a free plan and what should generally not?
The general advice is this question is all about balance. So you need to balance out free version that generates new leads to you. So for us, the primary purpose of the free version is to have as many websites using our chat widget as possible, and they will display powered by Jive chat link to all of their visitors. So that's what generates us that organic flow sign up. So if you have more free users, you have more inflow of those customers. If you limit the number of features of the free version, then you will have probably you'll have slower growth of users on your free plan, and the organic flow of customers will grow slower. But probably you will have a better conversion from free to paid. If you have too many features on the free plan and too little on the paid plan, then you'll have a lot of customers, but you will struggle with converting those customers into paid. So it's there probably should be a balance between the number of customers you sign up every month and number of customers converting to paid every month. So if you're happy with both of those numbers, then you're good. If you want to improve one or another, you should respectively increase or decrease number of features in the free plan. That's the logic we've been using over the years.
You have probably changed that scope not once, but a few times over the course of the 8 years that you've been out. So what's your process with handling the existing free users? Do the new changes affect them in your philosophy, or do you grandfather them in? How does it work?
Most of the times, yes. So we update the terms for all users. And I think there wasn't so occasions when we decreased number of features on the free plan. So most of the times we add new features to the paid plan or to the free plan, but I can't remember a situation when we moved a feature from free plan to paid plan. We just didn't need that.
So in that regard, you haven't really faced any, let's say, negative emotions from existing users about your updates on the scope?
Not exactly. We had a couple of shitstorms. So for example, when we updated the design of our widget that appeared on the website, and you can imagine how important that can be to some customers. So when we rolled out quite a big redesign for our widget, and we already had more than 100,000 users back then. It took us about a half a year, I think, to roll out those designs gradually and deal with all those people who didn't want to transition to new design. So at first, we gave them option to enable new design when they are comfortable to do that. Then we gave them grace period when they can continue using the old version of the widget, and then we disabled it. That was not easy. We got a lot of complaints, people saying that the old version is better than the new one. But basically, that's something that happens most of the time. So at any update, there are some people who think that you shouldn't do this update and leave things as they are. But you cannot stop the progress, and you have to deal with all those emotions. Well, most of the times, we give them free licenses for a while just to compensate for their discomfort. And we roll out those updates anyway.
Are there any mistakes to avoid that our listeners should be aware of? Because so far, so good. It seems like it's all cool. So anything that people can get wrong when going with their free plan?
Well, in the first version of our free plan, we offered people to choose which paid features they actually want to use. I don't know why, but it looks like a good idea to give them something like a shopping cart, where they can choose which features of the premium plan they are going to use, and like they can choose out of 10 checkboxes, and each checkbox adds to the price of the license. But I think that was a really, really bad idea, because instead of making one sale and overcoming one resistance point, we introduced 10 of those steps to do to make the sale. And actually, the conversions were really bad. The average check was not what we expected it to be. And then we switched from that model to providing just free just two versions of our product, free and paid. And then eventually, we added a third version for bigger companies who need SLA, NDA, and other stuff that's more expensive than the basic one. But I think that was a good idea to just provide two options, free and paid, and make a decision really, really simple for the customers.
How do you handle user onboarding? Well, not just onboarding, but the conversion from free to paid in addition to having live sales agent contact people. You probably have like dozens of emails and other things. So what is your strategy in that direction?
Well, trigger campaigns are a very important contact point for us. So we try to educate our customers to help them to move towards the goal. So they see the value of the premium features of our product that helps them to increase conversions on their side, to work more effectively with the customers. We try to educate them with trigger emails, with in-app messages. Yes, it's a very important part of the process for us.
Let's say if there is a classic 14-day trial, then there is this inflection point of 14 days into the journey when you're like, you can use the pressure to help them convert. While with the free plan, you don't really have that due date. So how do you go around? Because I used to run a product that had a free plan, an unsuccessful one. And it was a bit like, I don't know, beating a dead horse, sort of, trying to convert those free users. So what is the alternative? What's the best way of doing that?
Well, first of all, we have both free plan and free trial. So for first 14 days after sign up, you receive the professional version of JavaChat. You can use all the features that are available in the paid plan, and that turns into a pumpkin on day 14. Then we introduce our sales team, who try to do their best, make the importance of the paid version obvious to the customer, and get the conversion.
That sounds like it always works. I'm so happy for you.
Well, of course not. We have conversions on each step of the funnel. Some people who sign up do not become active users. Some active users do not become paid users. Some paid users do not extend their licenses. But that's how it works. We try to optimize all those numbers one by one, try to find problems, improve product, improve processes. It's an ongoing struggle.
One reference I'd love to make is to one of our past episodes when we had AD PNR here in the show, and he mentioned that one of their early mistakes with Conversio was making a forever free plan, and that sort of put a lot of really bad limitations on their relationships with the customers. What do you think of that? And I think the key point is the word forever, because you make an endless promise to people while it could be just free for now, sort of.
Well, I don't know what those guys are doing, Conversio, but most probably they don't get any value from forever free customers. We do. Every forever free customer of JavaChat generates new potential paid customers to us, because our widget is installed on every page of our website, of the websites for our customers, and it generates awareness. So it really makes sense for us to have a lot of free users. Probably, and that's not true for some of other products. For example, if this is if you run a tool that's under the hood and it's not visible to the customers, you probably won't get the same effect. And then you need to decide if having a free version of the product makes sense to you.
My co-founder Claire once called free users mini marketers. So you don't just have users, each of them is your mini marketer.
Yes, exactly. But you need to understand the mechanics. How does it work? For us, it's quite simple. You install the widget and display powered by JavaChat link to all of your website visitors. For other products, it might be not so obvious.
One last item I'd love to touch upon today is your experience with the affiliate program. So I think that has been working out well for you. Can you give us some insights and some wins and probably mistakes to avoid?
Yeah, that's true. Affiliate program is something that generates, I think, 15% of our revenue nowadays. And in the beginning, we made a leap of faith. We made a promise to our affiliates to pay 25 to 35% share of all revenues that we receive from customers referred by them indefinitely. So it's not only from first payment, it's from all payments that we receive from those customers. And I think that was a good thing to do. We earned trust of a large number of our partners. So right now, I think it's 2,000 active affiliates with signed agreement in our program who refer customers to us. Many of those partners are marketing agencies or website developers. They recommend JavaChat to their clients. And with many of them, we have relations for many years, and they receive a substantial stream of revenue from us.
So that still holds up, that you still share lifetime revenue with them.
Yep. Yes.
Awesome. I think to wrap up today's episode, if you were to give advice on what kind of businesses could benefit from having a free plan and what type of businesses absolutely should not, what would be your recommendation?
Well, I think the one thing to look for is the mechanics where free users will generate some sort of value for your business in either terms of marketing or, I don't know, data that you can use somehow for advertising purposes or whatever.
Let's not go in that direction.
Yes, it's a lot of big companies do that, and they do successfully. So if you understand that mechanics, if you see how free users will give something for your business, then you should definitely do that. We had this clear vision from the first day of our company, and probably that what helped us to launch. If you don't see how it might work for you, no big deal. There are a lot of other strategies to go with, and freemium is definitely not for all businesses.
Thanks so much for sharing your insights today, Tim. That was very helpful. And where can people find your product and yourself personally online?
Please visit our website. It's javachat.com. And myself is available on Facebook. Please come and ask me any questions you like.
Awesome. Well, thanks again, Tim. And hope you have a wonderful rest of your week.
Thanks for having me, Jane.